Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you live from my little studio in Old Thornhill, just north of Toronto. September 1961, near Indian Head, New Hampshire, Betty and Barney Hill have a disturbing encounter with a UFO while driving home from a short vacation. Later, under hypnosis, the couple recall having been abducted by aliens. The case stirred worldwide interest and enthralled the public and media for decades. The incident is mentioned in almost all UFO abduction books. It also became a target for debunkers, who still attack it today. But the complete story of what really happened that night, its effect on the participants and the findings of investigators, have never been told until Betty's niece, Kathleen Martin, along with co-author, the late Stanton Friedman, meticulously documented the Hill story in Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Kathleen has just released the 60th anniversary edition, which contains new material, and she joins me in the first half of the program to provide an insider's look at the alien abduction, previously unpublished information about the lives of the Hills before and after Barney's death in 1969, their status as celebrities, Betty's experiences as a UFO investigator, and other activities before Betty's death in 2004. Then, a fascinating account of an extraordinary journey through ancient history, modern science, and the birthing of a revolutionary new sound and light therapy that's helping thousands overcome their health concerns. At the age of 37, Gail Lynn's dream of making a difference in the world was rudely shattered when she learned that she had the heart of an 80-year-old. The accumulated stress of two challenging relationships and three extremely competitive careers in the automotive, telecommunications industry, and film industries had decimated her physical, emotional, and psychological reserves, leaving her with a medical diagnosis of severe cardiovascular stress. Determined to restore her health, Gail plunged into the world of energy medicine. When a series of full-body light and sound treatments reversed her diagnosis, she set out to uncover both the ancient history and modern science behind light and sound as healing. After opening a light and sound healing center in Colorado in 2010, a series of extraordinary synchronicities guided Gail to combine light and sound technologies with sacred geometry and Tesla mathematics. The result was a revolutionary vibra-acoustic resonance healing chamber called the Harmonic Egg, which is advancing frequency healing to an unimagined level. Gail Lynn will be here in hours 3 and 4. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Kathleen Martin works full-time as an author, alien abduction researcher, and lecturer. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, the first abductees whose story stirred worldwide interest. And she is the co-author of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, the 60th Anniversary Edition, now out and available. Kathleen, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Does it seem possible it's been 60 years since the abduction case?
My gosh, it really doesn't. Time flies so quickly, it seems. And you know, I was 13 years old when that occurred, and it's really difficult to believe that I'm this old now, I suppose.
Is there ever a day that goes by when you don't think about what happened to your aunt and uncle?
I don't think so. I think that it's on my mind every day. You know, it had a huge impact on my life. And
of course. I mean, it changed the trajectory of your life, didn't it?
It absolutely did. because I had no interest in UFOs at the time. I didn't even know about UFOs. It wasn't something that my family spoke of. And so, you know, it came as a real shock, and the kind of emotional discharge related to that you just never forget. I just remember where I was when I received the news. I had returned home from school. It was September 20th, 1961. My mother was on the telephone with my Aunt Betty, and my mother seemed concerned because Betty was concerned that a flying saucer had come so close to her and my Uncle Barney the previous night that they might have been contaminated. So Betty wanted my mother to call a neighbor of ours who was a physicist to ask what they should do. And eventually, within a couple of days, I heard the story myself because we drove to Betty's and Barney's home, which is about 20 miles away from my childhood home. And I saw the evidence, some of it at least, as well. And it was fascinating. It later became frightening, but it's something that I can never forget.
And when you went over to their house, did you notice, I mean, was there a marked difference in the way that your Aunt Betty and your Uncle Barney behaved prior, you know, when you had met with them? Because you spent a fair amount of time with them before before the incident. Did you notice a marked change in their behavior? Were they nervous, anxious, distant?
Barney was distant. Barney was normally gregarious, happy, outgoing. He always played chess with my brothers. He was always interested in hearing our news. And on this particular day, he sat just quietly in a corner near the telephone. My father joined him there, and my Aunt Betty told us that we could not speak with Barney on that day, that he was waiting for a return call from Pease Air Force Base. So he sat quietly and spoke with my father while Betty was animated. She was very curious about what had occurred and the evidence, such as shiny spots on the trunk of the car that caused a needle to whirl, the compass needle to whirl, indicating a magnetic field. Her watch that had been working just fine the previous evening before the event itself no longer worked, nor did Barney's, and they never ran again. There were so many questions. How the binocular strap had become broken. It was a leather strap. Barney's shoes were scraped. And her dress had been ruined. The hem was torn down on one side. The lining was torn from waist to hemline. The zipper that ran up the back of her dress was torn in the thick zipper fabric for about an inch, and the stitching, 2 inches of the stitching on the other side was torn. And it had been in fine condition when she had put it on the morning before this event. And all she and Barney did was behave like tourists in the car, driving, having a wonderful time in Montreal, sightseeing, leaving and deciding to drive back to their home on the seacoast of Portsmouth, anticipating an arrival at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, you just don't have your clothing destroyed by sitting in a car or having a great time on your vacation, walking around and sightseeing.
Right. So for those that are not familiar with the timeline, just let's just talk about it. You mentioned, okay, so they're in Montreal. They decide to come home and push right through. They're driving through the White Mountains of New Hampshire on their way back to Portsmouth. And they see, I guess, kind of a bright light in the sky. I guess Jupiter was visible in the night sky. Did they at some point think it might have been Jupiter that they were looking out through the car window?
No, because Jupiter doesn't move. And when this star-like object first appeared, it ascended into the air. And so that sparked Betty's curiosity. It was a bright light night. Barney was driving at about 50 to 55 miles per hour, and this light just moved differently than anything that she had ever seen before. So it sparked her curiosity, and she continued to watch it.
And this was a kind of a honeymoon for them, wasn't it? They'd only been married, what, a year and a half?
Yes, that's correct. They decided to go on this trip because I actually had been to Niagara Falls a month or two before Betty and Barney took their trip. They had been visiting. They visited my childhood home at least once a week, sometimes more. And I was showing them photographs I had of my trip to Niagara Falls. I just loved it. I had a great time. And Barney turned to Betty and said, "Have you ever been there?" And she said, "No, I haven't." And he said, "Well, maybe we could go sometime." And then in that September, mid-September period, Betty had a vacation from her job as a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. And Barney, who worked for the post office, decided to surprise her with a trip. And so that's how it happened. They went to Niagara Falls,
so,
and then through Toronto, stopping for the night about 112 miles west of Montreal, and then deciding to drive home through New Hampshire.
Right. So through the White Mountains, is it rural Route 3 they were on at some point through the mountains?
Yes.
They see this light. It's moving. And at some point, is it sort of tailing them?
It's flying beside their vehicle. And it is moving erratically, zigzag. It's ascending and descending vertically. It appears to be rotating. And they can see that it's lighted on one side as it rotates. They stopped once to take a look at this thing, and then they stopped again by the Old Man of the Mountain in upstate New Hampshire. It's located in Franconia Notch. And the old man's profile is 48 feet from forehead to chin, and Betty said that craft was at least 1.5 times, if not 2 times the length of the old man's profile. So they got out of the
interesting
car.
They were
looking at this craft through binoculars now because it was coming closer and closer. Got back in the car and headed south. Had you planned to say something?
No, I was just listening because this is all important information.
Okay.
But Barney was carrying a pistol, wasn't he?
He was. He had put the pistol into the car before they left. It was in the trunk of the car. And he took it with him because this was sort of a spur-of-the-moment vacation. They didn't have a lot of money with them. There were no credit cards except for gasoline credit cards in those days. And so they gathered their cash together, thought they had enough for the trip. But if they had to sleep on the side of the road, Barney wanted protection. Well, they never did have to sleep on the side of the road. And back at the Mount Cleveland picnic area, which was their first stop, he took the gun out of the trunk of the car because he was walking the dog. And there were bears in the area. It was a picnic area, and he decided that he would take the pistol from the trunk so that he could fire it if bears came out of the woods. And that was the reason. I know it was played up earlier in history as a tire iron that he took out of the trunk of the car when the craft was hovering only 200 feet above their vehicle, but that was a fictionalized part of the first book. Captured tells the complete story and the true story.
At what point did the craft land?
The craft hovered within 100 feet of the ground in North Lincoln, New Hampshire. That is when Barney had conscious recall of observing figures dressed in black, shiny uniforms and feared that he was going to be captured. And so he pulled the binoculars from his eyes, ran back to the car that was running. Betty was in the car. She didn't go into the field with him. And they went speeding down the highway, and the craft did not land until he and Betty had the vague memories of observing a fiery orb that was sitting on the ground. That was the landed craft, apparently. They also had conscious recall of observing a roadblock, but they didn't know where or when it occurred. And they remembered finding themselves on a dirt road with tall trees all around. But mysteriously, they were 35 miles south of that field that Barney had walked into to observe the craft when it was 100 feet above the him. And he and Betty had lost this time, about 2 to 3 hours of their time. And it was as if only a moment had passed from point A in North Lincoln to point B on very close to Route 93 in upstate New Hampshire still.
When they're driving away from this craft, the car starts to vibrate, right? It's making some very strange noises and vibrations. And what were they thinking at that point that was going on?
Well, yes, the car initially, they heard a series of code-like buzzing sounds that seemed to be striking the trunk of the vehicle, and it caused their vehicle to vibrate and for a tingling sensation to pass through their bodies. And when that occurred, they sort of lost track of everything. It was as if they were in a different kind of state, and that the next thing they knew, aside from those memories that I had told you about, was that they were 35 miles down the road, and they heard another set of these buzzing sounds striking the trunk of the car again, and they did not see the craft this time. And that's when Betty turned to Barney and said, "Well, Barney, now do you believe in flying saucers?" And he said, "Betty, don't be ridiculous. There's no such thing." And Betty thought that he was probably kidding her because he was the one who walked into the field and saw it. And but he said, "I can prove to you I can make that sound." And he stopped the car. He drove from one side of the road to the other. He did everything he could to reproduce that sound, that vibration, and he couldn't.
And when they arrived home, they had no idea that they were missing 2 hours, right? They thought they had arrived on time.
No, they realized that they had arrived later than they had anticipated. initially they did not fully understand that it was a full 2 to 3 hours. Even though they, their watches had stopped running, they checked the clock, and it was 5:15.
Okay, Kathleen, I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to, pardon the interruption, we're going to take a quick time out, come back and continue our discussion. The 60th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill alien abduction case. Kathleen Martin stays with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. Archaeologists announced the discovery of a 3,500-year-old lost golden city found in Luxor in Egypt. The city was built by King Amenhotep III, who was grandfather of the famous King Tut, and the massive structure houses roads, neighborhoods, bakeries, workshops, and even burials. Archaeologists dated the city using hieroglyphics found in pottery and on King Amenhotep III's stamp on bricks. You can read more about this fascinating story. The Lost Golden City of Egypt is found, and that's in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Kathleen Martin as we discuss the 60th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Kathleen Martin is with us, the niece of Betty Hill, and we're talking about the 60th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill alien abduction case, and we're working our way through the timeline. So they arrive home in the early hours of September 20th, 1961. They realize that they have, 2 hours of missing time. They notice their watches are no longer working. Betty has a strange stain on her dress. Your Uncle Barney's shoes are scuffed. What else did they notice as they work their way into the house? What else did they feel?
They felt what they called clammy. That's the word they used. They said that they felt far dirtier than they would on any road trip. It was just as if they were filthy, and they took long showers to try to wash away whatever that was on their body.
And at what point did they decide that they were going to call the Air National Guard Base, Pease Air National Guard Base?
Pease Air Force Base was located in Newington, New Hampshire. It was right next door to Portsmouth. And when Betty was on the phone with my mother, my father's best friend came in. He stopped by for coffee every night on his way home from work. And he told my mother to tell Betty and Barney that the Pease Air Force Base had notified the local police stations. He had been the chief of police in the small town of Newton. And if anyone saw a UFO, they should make a report to Pease Air Force Base. So being the good citizens that they were, Betty and Barney called Pease and filed a report of a very strange object moving erratically through the sky, and at the point where it swooped down, the report said that it was as large as a dinner plate held at arm's length, which is enormous when you think of a craft being in the air.
Right. And did the officials at Pease Air Force Base take it seriously? Did they do anything aside from a rudimentary investigation?
Well, they took it seriously initially and said that they were going to call Betty and Barney back because there had been a radar sighting of something unknown at 2:14 a.m. And that would have been about the time that Betty and Barney were released and back to their car. So they did initially take an interest, but then they just dismissed it. And I found that in all of the research that I have done over the years, in that time frame, the Air Force Project Blue Book was just tired. They didn't want media attention. The files indicate this, not Betty's and Barney's files, but the Air Force files. And so they dismissed a lot of these cases. And what they said initially was that it was an advertising searchlight. An advertising searchlight in a desolate area in the off season, in the middle of the night.
Gosh.
I think not.
Oh, gosh.
And then they thought, well, maybe it's the planet Jupiter, and they wrote in their report a contradiction to what their initial report said. The contradiction was they said in the second report that the craft was stationary at all times, which was a ridiculous statement, given that their original report contained the information about its erratic movement, its lateral movement and vertical movement.
How soon after the incident did your Aunt Betty start to have these a series of strange dreams?
It began 10 days after the incident, and she had 5 dreams in all. They occurred in the early morning, just before she rose and to go to work, and they seemed too real to be dreams in a way, because they contained conscious recall that she had of that night. But in the middle of all of this, the conscious recall on one end and conscious recall on the other, sandwiched in there was a memory of an abduction. And in the abduction, it was different than what came out under hypnosis. Her dreams were of very human-looking figures standing in the road. They were wearing blue caps and blue cadet uniforms. They had large noses, sort of like Jimmy Durante's, and appeared to be human in every way. And that is not what they remembered under hypnosis. But when you have a dream, when you're in this sort of hypnopompic state just before you awaken in the morning, then you can have a combination of reality, of the truth that you remember consciously, but sandwiched in there can be some fantasy material as you're attempting to resolve conflict in your life. And that conflict was definitely related to this UFO close encounter and missing time with the physical evidence that they discovered when they arrived home.
And what about Barney during this period when Betty was having these dreams for 5 nights consecutively and then they stopped? What about Barney? Was he having nightmares or anything like that?
Barney was not having nightmares. And, you know, it's unfortunate that he didn't, because I think that that probably contributed to the degree of post-traumatic stress disorder that he developed. Barney just wanted to forget about it. He was working nights at that time. And so he just wanted to dispense with the whole thing. In fact, he said to Betty, "Never tell anyone about this. No good can ever come of it."
And I want to just go back to those rings that were on the car, because we touched on it earlier. Someone suggested, maybe it was your father's friend, suggested they take a compass out to the car to determine whether there was any sort of electromagnetic activity happening. These three, I guess there were 3 rings on the trunk of the car. They looked like what, oil stains or something?
There were several circles on the trunk of the car. They were highly polished, as if someone had laid down a template and sprayed them with a clear, shiny spray. That's what it reminded me of when I was looking at it. And that's the way Betty and Barney described it as well. They had not been there the day before, but they were there on the afternoon after they returned home, and Betty went out to the car. She saw those, and my father's and mother's friend, who was a physicist, who was a neighbor of ours, recommended that if Betty had a compass, she should take it out to the car and see how the needle reacts. And that is when she discovered those new spots on the trunk of the car and was so curious about them. Barney wasn't curious about them at all. He just wanted to forget. And so he initially refused to go out to look at how the compass reacted to that area of the car. And finally, their upstairs neighbors went out, and then Barney sort of said, okay, I'll go out and I'll take a look. And he did, and he held the compass, he saw the needle whirl, and he turned around and said to Betty, oh, it's only a cheap compass, forget about it.
And did you see these marks on the car yourself?
Yes, I did. 2 days after this event occurred, my family drove to Betty's and Barney's house, and I did see the marks on the trunk of the vehicle. Very curious.
And did you see the compass twirl around as well?
I don't remember that part of it. If Betty had the compass, she was showing my mother, and I was with my two younger brothers. The youngest one was too short to see the trunk of the car. It was rather high. And so my other brother and I were lifting him up so that he could see those spots. And we were taking our fingers and trying to rub them off. And that's when Betty and my mother became very concerned and said, you know, don't touch those. It could harm you. And then took us back into the house.
And you're 13 at the time, and so how are you absorbing this information about what happened to your aunt and uncle? Did it make any sense to you? Were you frightened?
Well, at first I was very curious and dumbfounded, and over time I became frightened, especially as more memories started to emerge, and then after they were hypnotized and permitted to recall what really had occurred, what they stated under hypnosis. That was very frightening, and I became fearful of the dark. If I were crossing the street at night to visit my grandparents, for example, who lived across the street from me, then I would run as fast as I could possibly run, fearful that I might get taken, like Betty and Barney.
And let's go back to your aunt's dress and that strange. I know it was torn, but there was also a strange stain on the dress. How did she preserve the evidence, and who did she send it to?
She did preserve the evidence on the dress. She kept it until there was scientific interest, and the first scientific interest was through a UFO researcher of high standing, Leonard Stringfield. And he lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he contacted the chemistry department at the University of Cincinnati, and Betty sent samples from the dress to the University of Cincinnati for analysis. So they were the first ones. This was during the 1970s. And they discovered that the elemental compounds on the dress were strange in relation to what seemed to be some kind of biological substance on the dress. So they did all sorts of scientific analyses on the dress, attempting to recreate that type of stain using different chemicals on it. They were not able to produce that kind of stain.
Interesting. And during this time, you know, the testing was done in the 70s, but I mean in the immediate aftermath, they never went to the papers. They were not interested in speaking to the media, but they did start to speak to, I guess, some UFO groups, right?
Yes, they made a report to the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and Walter Webb, who was an astronomer at the Hayden Planetarium in Boston, Massachusetts, in early October drove to their home and interviewed them separately and then together for 6 hours. But Betty and Barney told him that they wanted this to remain confidential. He wrote a confidential report. Betty and Barney were willing to speak to UFO investigators, to scientists who were interested in the case, to people in the military who were interested in the case, and the family and close friends. But we were sworn to secrecy. So it wasn't until much later that the story was told against Betty and Barney's will. And it was extraordinarily distressing to them, because by the time it was told, they were very active in the civil rights movement. They were active in New Hampshire politics. Barney was becoming well known around the state. He had been appointed to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights as the state advisory board member. He had also received an award from Sergeant Shriver and the governor of New Hampshire for the work that he and Betty did to develop the Rockingham County Community Action Program through the Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington. So they were doing very good things for the people of New Hampshire. They were working on a literacy program, because in those days, you had to pass a literacy test in order to vote, and they were encouraging people to vote. They worked on a presidential campaign and were invited guests by the President of the United States, and I was as well, because I was close to them, and they were encouraging me to do good things when I was a teenager. But this was terrible.
Right. So the last thing they needed, and also a biracial couple in the early 1960s, the last thing they needed was for this story to get out into the media and add even further pressure. It must have been very difficult for them as a biracial couple in the early 1960s. We're going to head into a break here shortly again, Kathleen. The top of the hour approaches. When we come back, we'll talk about how they made the decision to undergo hypnosis and, of course, what was revealed during those hypnosis sessions with Betty and Barney. Those were conducted separately, of course. And then at the bottom of the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for questions and comments. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM.